The 1998 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 212, Community and Conscience in Authoritative States, a paper by Sherry Woodworth. The chair is Beverly Johnson. This is a 60-minute session taped on a 90-minute tape, so the second half of Side 2 will be blank.
I'm really... Good morning. We welcome you to this session of Sunstone. It's number 212 in your book, called Community and Conscience in Authoritarian States by Sherry Woodworth. We have an hour in here, and Sherry plans to talk about 45 minutes, and then we'll have questions. And I'll tell you a little bit about Sherry. She was born and raised in California. In 1987, she graduated from BYU with honors in Russian language and literature. In 1989, she got a master's degree from Harvard in Russian and East European studies. From 89 to 91, she and her husband Brad lived in Moscow and Tallinn. They were officially sponsored by the first non-governmental college to be formed in the Soviet Union. Also, part of this time, she was officially employed by TASS, the old Soviet news agency. They moved from Estonia just a few months after the August coup of 1991, when the Baltic republics declared their independence and were officially recognized. From Tallinn, they went to Prague in the year 91 and 92, and she worked for an independent international university set up by the billionaire philanthropist George Soros. In 92 and 95, they returned to graduate school to PhD programs in history at Indiana University. And in 95, she transferred from Indiana to Yale, where she's now writing her dissertation. Sherry Woodworth. If you want to put that in there. When I was talking with Albert about possibly speaking, Albert and I were talking about things that interest him, and one thing he mentioned were spiritual journeys, and I really latched on to that idea because it seems like I've made a spiritual journey over the last 10 years since I started at BYU, and I've also made a physical journey. As you can tell from my resume, I move around a lot, and in fact, I just arrived from Estonia this week, coming to speak at Sunstone, planning to miss the marvelous northern summer in order to come and be in Utah. There's some things I want to say preliminary, and that is what I'm planning to talk about and what I'm not planning to talk about, so that you won't be anticipating something that's not coming. I'm talking about my experiences in Russia and the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, but I'm not talking about missionary work there or the church being established there. I'm talking more about my personal dialogue of Russian culture and Russian studies in general and how that changes my understanding and relationship with my home culture, which I think of as Mormonism, and the core culture as it's here in Utah in the center or in California where I grew up, as opposed to the culture in the mission field, which is very different. And I don't want you to get the impression that what I'm talking about has to necessarily deal with the church and the mission field, where I understand things are very difficult. But I wanted to begin talking about my experience at BYU, where I started to study Russian in 1983. People often ask me, especially when I'm in Russia, why are you studying Russian? Why are you doing this? And over the years, I have never come up with a good answer, even though I've tried many. And yet, I think there is an answer underneath there, an answer which does relate back specifically to why I was at BYU. Actually, I started studying Russian in high school. I was a scripture chase champion of my seminary, of my stake. I was very happy to be that. And there's something about my study of Russian which is connected, I think, to that, to my early trying to get in and read Hugh Nibley and try to figure these things out. And if you remember, if you're not too young, the Cold War, which was not all that long ago, and the image of Russia as the great mystery and the great inscrutable, but also this great threatening thing, a matter of life and death, because it could bring annihilation for our whole country, and Russia as the enemy, and as bringing up questions of good and bad, and of evil, and of good in the moral sense. And so I think my study of Russian and Russian culture somewhat goes back to the similar idea of trying to get into the mysteries of Mormonism, trying to get in to find out what's good and what's bad, what's the core, what really matters for my existence, a matter of life and death, through my own salvation. And this may seem like a tenuous connection, but somebody who's at a young age, a teenager, trying to find out what really matters in life. So I went off to BYU and I started to study Russian. And the Russian faculty there have, I think, all taken their turn now at being mission presidents. These were my first professors I had at BYU. One of the books that I was introduced to in study of Russian culture, and which had an enormous effect on my understanding of the Soviet Union, is the memoirs of Evgenia Ginzburg. This is the first volume called Journey into the Whirlwind, and she wrote a second volume called Within the Whirlwind. This book was introduced to me by Tom Rogers, who finished as mission president in St. Petersburg a couple of years ago, and it is her memoirs of being tried in 1934 during one of the first purges under Stalinism, and her subsequent time in the camps as she survived being sent to Siberia to some of the worst camps, labor camps and prison camps that were then, and then she stayed in exile in Siberia for most of the rest of her life. She writes on the very first page, the very first chapter of the book, about how she believed in the good parts of communism, the ideal of helping people to be better, of improving their lives and educating people and all of these things, which the ideal of communism really did do. And she writes, "I don't want to sound pretentious, but I must say in all honesty that had I been ordered to die for the party, not once, but three times, that very night, the night that she received her first telephone call to come before the tribunal, that very night in that snowy winter dawn, I would have obeyed without the slightest hesitation. I had not the shadow of a doubt of the rightness of the party line. It was only Stalin that I could not bring myself to idolize, and perhaps this was just my instinct. But it was already becoming the fashion to idolize him. If I felt this vague disquiet about him, I carefully concealed it even from myself." So she was called in to a kangaroo court, basically, which, after some mental anguish on her part, convicted her of anti-state terrorist activities, which was entirely invented. And her first big trial was in her mind as she learned to separate herself from this ideal that she believed in, the ideal of all the good things that she had bought into and wanted to accomplish, and then the reality of this apparatus, which was becoming paranoid and was beginning to arrest people all over. In fact, as she goes to prison for the first time and is held in the underground prisons in the city, every new person who gets arrested, and there are many, many, brings news that there's dozens and tens more people who are being arrested as well. And her later time in the camp was a physical trial, but it was this early break she had with her faith of having to then establish where she stood and what she believed in after having been betrayed like this, which was the real spiritual trial which began her journey. I talk about this book because, as I say, it had a big influence on me, talking about the individual within the authoritarian state. And it depicts some of the ways that the Soviet Union at that time was the epitome of the authoritarian state, the way that a power was abused, the way that the authorities not only physically imprisoned you, but told you, you did this, you said this, you believe this, it's in your head, without any justification, that the sort of abuse of mental sway over people. The search for enemies constantly, of this strange paradox of the state which is so strong and yet all the time believes itself under attack from outside or from within, even worse. And turning your own faith back on you in order to convict you and to use you and to use you to betray other people. And I think about this in the context of when I was studying at BYU and trying to find out what was good and evil. And I think, This, to me, showed why the Soviet Union was evil. Not in some simplistic sense, like Cleon Skousen's Red Under the Bed, ooh, they're bad commies, but in a personal moral sense, in a complex sense, in the individual effect on people's lives and the way that it destroys their souls. Other things we know about the Soviet Union during its days of strength, about evil things that it did, about persecution of religions, destruction of churches, destruction of people's memories, the arrests and deportations which divided families and communities. These things I didn't experience when I was living there in the from 1989 to 1991. But I heard stories. There was a time when I was living in Estonia with my husband the first time in 1990, and we had gone off to a little village during the summer, and we were staying with some friends of friends, and we decided to go for a walk, and we ran across this little church in the forest, and we walked into the church, and there was a priest there with the long uncut beard and the long robes, and he was conducting a sort of ceremony for some children about this big and also some adults. And we didn't know what it was, but as we watched, we realized this was a baptism because they hadn't been able to do baptisms before. And he was anointing them on the forehead with a cross of oil and on their lips and various other things. And we went back to our hosts, and we mentioned that we had been at this church, and we heard from this old man who was a great uncle or somebody of the host there, and he told us about the church, and he told us about how he had been a deacon for the church all his life, and that during the times of the communists he had actually been deported to Siberia because of his religious activities, which were really very modest, and then how he had come back and the things that he had suffered. On a smaller scale, I heard from a friend of mine who's my age that when she was a school child, they wanted to celebrate Easter. Her family kept religious tradition. She's Lutheran, as most people in Estonia are. And for Easter, to go to Midnight Mass, her family wanted to go, and they went, although they knew that there would be people there to report who was attending church, and that her school teachers were pressured into standing outside the church door so they could identify children that went in through the doors to go to Easter services. And they could write their names down and send them in saying, this is who went to church. Ginsburg also, in her memoirs, writes about some of the other people she encountered in the camps. Among them were the very strongest of the Russian Orthodox, old believers, who were, I cannot imagine why, considered a threat to the state, simply because, I suppose, they were so strong in their belief. And they were arrested and sent off to the camps. And Ginsburg writes that they, because of their faith, because they believed in something beyond us, seemed to be the ones that could survive the best. She said they would stand in icy water barefoot up to their knees sawing logs on the tundra during the thaw. And they didn't seem to get discouraged any more than the other prisoners. In fact, they helped buoy each other up. And the contrast between, again, this authoritarian state, which tries to press out of people's spirits what they believe in, and then the way people just keep it going and keep it going. And then the last thing that is indicative of the authoritarian state is the intellectual community and the control that the state tries to exercise over what people say, what people think, what people discuss about, what people write. And the way that the intellectual community still hangs on to these things is saying, this is important. We have to talk about this. We need to have literature. We need to have freedom of speech. They didn't dare argue that they needed to have freedom of speech in the public sense, because they knew they would never get that. But within their souls, they said, we have to be able to have a way to discuss things that are important to us, to call things into question, or just to bring things up, to look at all sides of them, rather than what the state was always telling them, there is one right answer, there's only one way to do this. The intellectual community, although as a percentage of the population was very small, it was really the soul and the spirit of Russian culture, which I think kept the good parts of Russian culture going under the Soviet regime. And it was fierce because of the opposition to it. And it survived into the times when things got better, into the time of Glasnost, as we've all heard about how the press opened up and things were able to be published that they weren't published before. For me, this happened when I was at Harvard in the master's program. I had left BYU, and the summer of 1989, if you remember, was a very important summer. It was the same summer that there was the demonstration of Tiananmen Square in China, which was brutally suppressed. But also that same time, almost within the same weeks, I think it was in July, there was a Communist Party conference which was held, a general conference. And these conferences had been held frequently. They were a regular sort of thing. But the way things always went before was only selected people were allowed to attend. They had their party cards in a red billfold sort of thing. The chairman had all the speeches scripted out. Then he would call for a vote. Everybody voted in favor by holding up their little red cards, and that was the end. In July of 1989, for the first time, people were allowed to actually vote, and people were allowed to actually get up and give unplanned speeches. And Mikhail Gorbachev conducted the whole thing, and admirably, I must admit, because he was put in a new position of having to reconcile people who would say different things, which had never happened before. And this was where, surprisingly enough, some of the well-known intellectuals got up and spoke in a national political event, which you don't see any of America's great writers standing up to speak to Congress, nor do you see the entire country tuning in on television to watch it hours and hours every day, because it's so exciting. One of the people who spoke was Sakharov, who died shortly. He died just that next December, atomic physicist who was instrumental in building the atomic bombs, inventing nuclear weapons for Russia, and his conscience to stand against the state, which told him, all of this is justified, don't ask any questions. But he, through his work with nuclear weapons, realized the extreme power that they had and that he had to stand up and speak against them. And another intellectual, which is perhaps more surprising for his involvement in politics, his name is Lihachev. He lives in St. Petersburg, and he studies early Russian culture, which is my specialty. And you'd think, good grief, history that's 500 years old, how could that be relevant to modern politics in the Soviet Union? And yet everybody in the country knows him as a cultural spiritual leader. And he was already over 80 when he got up to speak at this conference in 1989, a frail man. And yet the spiritual power that he held for people because he held on to these ideals. We weren't able to judge at the time in 1989 what would happen next. But more importantly, we weren't able to judge, I think, the extent to which the Soviet system had killed people's souls and destroyed them or left them with these toxins and poisons in an intellectual and a spiritual sense. Things that I think came out in the next few years as the country tried to move into a post-Soviet reality. I was living then in Estonia, and I worked some for TASS, as Beverly mentioned, the official Soviet news agency, which was the epitome of just telling the things that are nice stories, don't have any criticism. And it was so exciting for me to be able to work in the news agency at this time because the Estonian branch had basically separated itself off and said, we're not going to follow your rules anymore. We're going to write the news. And one of the things that was a news story during those years was this Soviet suppression in Vilnius and the importance of getting the news out and being able to say what was really happening and not having someone say, no, 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 you can only say what's good and what is good news. But to be able to say that the army is killing people and repressing people. And then we went to live in Prague, my husband and I got a job working at independent university, which was founded, as Beverly mentioned, by a billionaire who's a Hungarian emigre and now lives in New York. And in Estonia as well, we had been working in connection with a university because from the very first we had understood or been shown by our colleagues and students and friends how the Soviet system had deformed the university system. When they say what you can say and what you can't say, what you can write about and what you can't write about in the university, the best minds of the university were put in a straitjacket. Lihachev, as an academic and a historian in St. Petersburg, was one of the few people who found a way to sort of get around this and to speak in what they called Aesopian language, which is to say one thing, but your readers can understand it as an allegory for something else, so that you don't get in trouble because you're not exactly saying that Stalin was an absolute dictator and was cruel and evil and ruined the country. But if you say Ivan the Terrible was an absolute dictator and was cruel and evil and ruined the country, you know what I mean. And people did know what was meant, and they understood, and this was a way of getting around the formal censorship. So we worked in universities because universities were important to us. Universities are important to me. I had had such an intellectual but also spiritual experience during my time at BYU, which opened up this whole world for me. And I realized that I wanted every student who goes to college to have the same sort of enlivening, opening up experience when they go to university. And instead of what was then current in the Soviet system, which was a cynicism, a disbelief, of dismissal of the professors because they were all party hacks and because they all had to watch what they said and because none of them had freedom of thought or freedom of expression. So this small university began operating in Tallinn while we were there, and we helped them and worked with them some. And the first thing that they established was the curriculum for humanities, for studying literature and language and history of Estonia, all of these things which had been more or less suppressed under the Soviet Union. And then we went to Prague, and I worked for this international university, which brought in students from all over Eastern Europe. And again, although the economic reform was number one in everybody's mind at that time, among the things that the university taught were humanities, art history, philosophy, because these are the foundations for the society, and these were things that were most affected by this authoritarian but the censorship regime. After that, we returned to the United States and went back into graduate school, and these experiences stayed with me, as you can imagine, and they affected my relationship to the church. I can't deny that, and I don't want to soften things for you, but I'll say that after dealing, for example, with the Soviet system, including the KGB, I didn't have direct dealings with them, but we were always told to be aware that we were possibly being watched or being reported on. We had sometimes official representatives at institutions who were so-called bureaucrat X, but were actually KGB bureaucrat X that we had to deal with. After having dealt with that sort of system, I am uncomfortable with the church's records office. This may seem totally benign to you, but there's something about keeping records on everybody, which now sits uneasily on my soul. And I do believe that everybody, all the ward clerks in the world, you know, deserve a gold medal because they have to work so hard and do this work. And yet sometimes I have this question of spiritually, I understand that for the administration of the kingdom it's all necessary, but spiritually, what is the spiritual cost of going to worship where you have to tick off your name every time? Could you go and worship without having to report in of what you've done? Could you go to church to be directly in touch with the Lord? Most people I know don't find that the official role being passed around comes between them and the Lord, but I've been, as I said, affected by being in the Soviet Union. Another thing which is I'm very sensitive about now is the interference from leaders above, and not just that they call somebody in and say, I don't want you speaking at Sunstone, or I don't want you publishing in Sunstone. More importantly to me is the way the chain of command works and taking responsibility if a bishop calls somebody in saying, this was my idea, it's me who found out that you were publishing in Sunstone or speaking at Sunstone, as opposed to saying, no, somebody higher up told me to do this and I'm being obedient and following their words. As we've had experience, people we know, some of the people in this room, the sort of hiding what's going on in the church administrative structure is very disturbing to me, because there were so many functionaries and bureaucrats in the Soviet system who believed what they were doing and believed that what they had to do was necessary, and at the same time didn't take personal responsibility for it. They said, I was ordered to do this, therefore it's not on my soul. It's not my responsibility. So I'm very uncomfortable with that. And I'm very much invested in, I very much believe in the importance of having a free forum for discussion, having seen how the intellectual community in the Soviet Union kept alive the spirit of Russian culture despite all of this pressure. I am excited that we have Sunstone. I am excited that we have a place where people can come together and can talk, and nobody is looking over my shoulder, and nobody says what I can say and what I can't say. They can only say, we think that what you have is important or is of interest to other people, or we don't think it's important. If it's not important, it's not the same as saying you can't say it. So on the one hand, I realize how difficult it is to keep Sunstone Symposia going and to keep the magazine going and to keep dialogue going and another independent forum. But I am so convinced now of how important it is, and I'm so glad you're all here, that I wish I could put you all in Moscow in 1989 for 2 months, and then you would understand what a privilege it is to be able just to gather and to talk about things that are bothering you. I mean, things say, I have doubts about this or that, which seems like such an easy thing it should be said, and yet to not be able to say that or not to find anybody that would listen to you. It's just a horrible, as I said, soul-killing sort of regime. And finally, one of the things that has really affected me in my study of Russian history, in my time living there, is the importance of the freedom of the university. And I began this presentation with BYU because that's where my personal journey begins. But it also ends with BYU because that hits me right in the heart right now, about what's happening there. I'm somewhat scarred or jaded by having listened to stories of purges in Soviet universities, and maybe I'm being too suspicious, but I listen to friends and colleagues at BYU, and how many of them will come to me and say, I can't talk about this with anybody, and we're not allowed to say this publicly, but I'm afraid for my job. I'm afraid for people who are working in my department. I'm afraid to teach what I think needs to be taught in my discipline. And I've invested my life now in universities because I am finishing a doctorate with the hope that I will spend my entire life in a university teaching, because that's what I think is so important for, as I said, the understructure of society, of giving people a way of thinking through things, of giving them mental tools for things. And I wonder if BYU is betraying itself and selling itself short. And the amazing thing is, to me, what I see as a parallel with the Soviet Union, in the sense that the Soviet Union was strong, and yet they were always fearful of enemies, hiding. And I look at the church now, and I see the church is strong. We have more members than before financially. The church is extremely solvent. I mean, we're able to build buildings, we're able to build temples, we're able to support the members. There is a great enthusiasm, I think, about being Mormon. There's a great identification. There's also more and more understanding in American culture in general about what Mormons are and all this positive publicity. And why are we looking for enemies like this? Why are people at BYU afraid to speak out, and afraid with justification, because people get fired, people get discontinued? And it makes me very sad, because, again, I see them selling away the strength in looking for a weakness which isn't there. One of the last things that I attended in Tallinn before I came here was a conference that was held. It was supposed to be, or it was entitled, and it was, an open conference to discuss toleration and trust. This was the second conference, which had been held in the city. And again, it was underwritten by the same Soros Foundation, which is funded by this billionaire in New York. And they set us up in a very nice hotel, gave us free lunch, and invited anybody who is, works in the journalist community or in the writing community or in the university, come, let's discuss what trust and what tolerance is and why we need it. In Estonia, this is a very difficult issue right now because they have a Russian population in the city, which came in mostly under the Soviet regime, and because of the Soviet system. And they're not sure to what extent those Russians are loyal to the current regime. In other words, if Russia threatened Estonia, and Estonia militarily is completely indefensible because it's so small, but still you would want to know that there weren't people betraying you to the enemy. And the difficulty of dealing with trust and tolerance in your society when your very existence is at stake. They came together to discuss this, and at the same time, within a few weeks, there was a publication of a book which had been translated into Estonian, a book by an American philosopher named Michael Walzer, who works out of Princeton. The book was called On Toleration, and he discussed how societies develop this sort of toleration for things that you individually may not like, but you believe should exist. And it was quite amazing that this book had been found and translated into Estonian and published so fast. So this discussion is going on. And I was sitting in this conference, and I couldn't help thinking of the Mormon example. And I said, how much toleration and how much trust do we need within the Mormon community if we are to remain a community? And is our situation like what's going on in Estonia, and is it not like it? In most senses, I think it's not like it. I think we feel the same urgency of the question, but it's not like it because we're much stronger and we are not faced with a military neighbor, which is so many times our might, which will physically exterminate us. And yet to see the Estonians making those steps forward, even though it was so much more difficult for them, gave me an example to say, well, in our Mormon community, how can we establish tolerance? How can we not be afraid of criticism from inside? How can we trust people? And finally, I wanted to point out the example of why ideas are important. Everybody who's here already believes that ideas are important. But I was thinking of this in terms of this philanthropist that I worked for. He has, already in 1992, he had donated over $100 million to reform in Eastern Europe. And his activities since then have grown exponentially. So we're talking in the hundreds of millions of dollars he has given of his own private fortune, because it's all his. He just gave it away. And what did he support? What did he put his money into? Economic reform to some degree. But basically he said, no, the officials have got to handle that. Health programs to some degree, helping with, especially with medical services in Bosnia and wartime Yugoslavia. The vast majority of the money he put into supporting universities, supporting intellectuals, supporting scientists, grants to people to keep thinking and working through these issues, because now in the time of transition, it was even more important. And again, I see that as an example to us. If there's any billionaires in the room, please raise your hand. And I'm not a billionaire, so this is I'm willing to sacrifice somebody else's money. But I have my time, I have my energy, and I believe that I can and should give this time and energy to put it back into the Mormon community because it's so necessary. Instead of going off and saying, well, they'll figure it out on their own. Those were the things that I've learned in my dealing with Russian studies in the Soviet Union, and I hope they've made some sense to you. I think we're ready to take questions. And we have to finish at what time? It's 9:20 right now, right? Okay. In the back.
Hey, I've got two questions. First of all, I want to know where you're living now. Are you in Estonia or are you here?
The question is where I'm living now, and I am living in Estonia. I'm here in the United States for the month of August, and I'm going back to Estonia. Well, let me go to the first question, which is touchy, because it's an overstatement to say, geez, the Mormon Church is repressive and authoritarian, just like the Soviet Union. But it's scary because you think of something, just like when you look for symptoms of a disease that's developing, You know, if spinal meningitis is going around and you get a sore throat, you say, let's look for the symptoms and see if this is anything like. And I have to say that it's absolutely true. The Mormon community is full of positive energy and wonderful things in the way the Soviet Union was not, which is one reason that I don't want it to get this creeping, what I see as emphasis on authority, which is one of the main poisons which killed the Soviet system. My friends and I, other students who studied Russian at BYU and later went to live in the country, would sometimes get together and write out our lists of things that are similar, which was a little evil thing to do. And we would, for example, one of the first things that we saw which was similar was these, you know how the Ensign used to and probably still does once a year publish a centerfold issue with the general authorities all in this inside. I'm sorry, the male general authorities, the primary presidency and the Rift Study presidency are not included in the young women's, I understand. So the by rank, biggest picture is president, two counselors, and then these ranks of people. This is a very good reason to do this so that you know who is who, and when they come to speak at your state conference, you can point to their picture and say, this is who it is, and you see them at general conference. But it is eerily similar to the sort of charts that the Soviet Union produced, which had almost exactly the same format. President, council, and then the lower body, which had several dozen people, like the Quorum of 70s, and how these pictures were put up in every classroom, and students were asked to venerate and to admire their leaders and to know their leaders. And the question is this admiration and veneration earned? Is it something that the person feels inside, or is it something that you're sort of told to do because you're supposed to do it? I would hope that when we look at the chart of general authorities and we see people that we know or people that we've seen speak, people whose writings we know, that the veneration comes from inside. It doesn't come from the fact that they exist on a chart which tells us who's who and what position they hold. Other things that were often held in common.
The question is
dissimilarity. Oh,
I'm sorry. Dissimilarity. I want to know the
dissimilarity. The dissimilarities is the, for one thing, the means of enforcement. The Soviet Union had very real means of arresting you, torturing you, killing you. The enforcement, or the way of keeping people all of one mind, is in the Mormon Church, is, of course, all spiritual. It's guilt feelings or telling you that either you're endangering your own soul or you're endangering other people. Endangering other people is even more powerful because, especially if it's not identified who, it's just this vague threat. Somehow you're an enemy to the system, but we won't tell you exactly who you're being an enemy to. And it can be, it seems to me, at least from the example of Ginsburg's memoirs that I began with, physically to take you and put you in prison can be extremely arduous, but to put you through a spiritual torture, I wouldn't underestimate that in any sense. And those people who have been doing what they believe to be right and trying, not trying to harm anybody, and yet are called in and put in this sort of straitjacket, I find that very dissimilar but very scary. Very scary. I wouldn't want to see that happen to anybody. Other dissimilarities are one thing that I think the Mormon community produces its own positive energy in many respects. I don't think that we do these mass-produced sort of rallies where everybody gets together and waves flags. I understand the sesquicentennial last year had a few things, but... But in general, I mean, people do this because they want to do it, and I think that that's good. This is a community which holds together because the individuals hold together. It's not a community that's in prison where nobody can escape, and I think that is a very good thing. That's what I talked about, positive energy within the community. Now, your second question was much more complex, and I certainly don't have time to... We don't have time to talk about it very much, and I certainly don't feel qualified to speak on it very well. I mean, this is the sort of thing where we really should have a discussion. I didn't quite understand, to rephrase the question, the ideals that exist within the Mormon community, how to keep them strong and how to keep them good and true to their purpose without, as you said, becoming like some other religious organizations. You mentioned Muslims, Catholics, and I didn't understand if you meant that they were simply divisive within themselves or that they were actually fizzling out, or...
We start out with these great ideals about love our neighbor and tolerance and all these things, even in the Old Testament, the Decalogue. I mean, the wonderful things about how you treat your neighbor and how you deal with other people. And we've created an institution to try to inculcate and tell people these wonderful things. And there's the danger or the temptation for the institution to say, or to go to the extreme and say, in order to protect this wonderful faith that we have, we've got to kill everybody else that doesn't believe, or if there is a threat from outside, even ideas coming in from other ideas, we can't have that because it might lead people away from this wonderful faith and this wonderful ideals that we have. How do we prevent ourselves from becoming, taking these ideals and having the institution pervert them, or us pervert
them? That's such a good comment. I hope that will come through on the tape. I can't repeat all of it. But I think it's only fair to say that there is an institutional structure and that it will exist and that it's not bad. And there are people who need to focus on the institutional structure. And that's their job, to make sure that this structure continues so that we have a forum for our community. The vehicle. But then all the rest of us, who aren't officially church bureaucrats, we get to concentrate on the ideals, right? It's like we have this marvelous garden, and to keep the garden from being overrun by wild cattle and picked apart by birds and depillaged by wild Huns, we build this big wall around it. And then all the energy goes into building the wall and building the wall. Well, let the wall builders build the wall. Let them focus on what they want to do. And all the rest of us, the only thing that I can say is it's the people with ideals that have to keep talking about them, and especially in forums like this. Let's go to the one in the back and then here in the front.
And I just thinking a little bit, your question, you know, started me thinking. And one difference is that in our society, in American society certainly, you've got the pluralism, you've got the choice, and so a Mormon religion doesn't have the same monopolistic, it's not either the standard line or cynicism. It's you believe in Mormonism, or if you quit, you know, if the authoritarian, whatever turns you off, if eventually you quit liking it, you have an alternative to somewhere else or something. And that sounds nice, that sounds positive, but I wonder if that's almost an excuse for further extremism or further control, further authoritarian behavior by the church, where we can say, hey, we this is what we dish out. If you don't like it, you know, go somewhere else. We have ways to kick you out, and we have ways to let you gently go out, but we can be how we...
I had repellers during the ERA thing, and then it spread. I'm appalled. I'm appalled at what I'm hearing about people being afraid to speak up.
Well, where are you from?
I'm from California.
Well, I grew up in California, and different parts of California have very strong organizations. This is something which comes, it's a central phenomenon, it's the core phenomenon, and I absolutely agree that in the outer areas, even within America, let alone within foreign countries, it's much more local initiative and less sort of hierarchy, but I don't think it's just my group of friends, but you've heard it from other people too.
I think it's terrible.
Yeah.
Wait, what? The church is doing.
Well, certain people come to the attention.
Does your bishop really tell you what you can or can't say?
Is that Janice? Are you here? Yes, Janice was excommunicated for publishing in Dialogue, if that's a proper summary in a word. Nadine Hansen, who's sitting right behind you, has been called in for Sunstone presentation. For Sunstone presentation. Janice? Well, you know, the truth is, even in the Soviet Union, during the purges, when thousands of people were being arrested for these ideological crimes, the average person didn't know or didn't care or believed that they were really guilty. And the truth is that the people who are interested in these issues, people who want to get together and talk about things like this, are a small percentage of the population. But this is we're the leaven. We're the leaven in the lump. I hope we are the leaven. I hope we're not the poison in the lump. But that's what some people would believe. There was a question here.
Mm-hmm.
When you say you believe this way, that I think is a key idea of accepting that people have different experiences and therefore they come out with different beliefs, which may fit all within a general sphere or may actually be very different on some things. And this acceptance of other people's beliefs is, I think, one of the good things that we can inject into our Mormon life, but it's something that I don't think is there very well on its own. And I think that is a key idea, and I'm glad you brought it up. Nadine? And let's see. We still have 10 minutes. Yeah.
One of the things that I think keeps an institution healthy and strong and avoids excesses is a willingness of the leadership to re-examine itself.
Mm.
Now, I think that within the church, we have a leadership that does, in fact, do that, but it doesn't want us to know that it does it. And so I think that this kind of a discussion is important. It's important for all kinds of issues to be examined and brought into the public light and be open for discussion. And I do think that church leaders hear what we say, and some of them listen, and things do change, but we kind of pretend like nothing changes. And so the ordinary person in the church doesn't notice that this discussion is going on, isn't aware of it. And we kind of hear half the dialogue sometimes at conference where we're aware of what church leaders are saying, and that they might be in response or counterpoint to things that are said in in the independent forum. But that's not evident to somebody who doesn't know, hasn't heard the other half of the dialogue.
For example, child abuse, which was brought up as a very sensitive issue, first in forums like this, because there were some real improvements that could be made, to put it lightly. And then the church has taken steps, at least has acknowledged there might be child abuse in your ward. We're trying to help you find a way to deal with it. But they didn't say, thank you, Sunstoners, for pointing that out to us. Nadine, are you finished?
More or less. I'll listen to you talk.
Okay, Art.
Well, I wanted to, my comment here is to thank you for sharing what I perceive to be a youthful, cultivated authenticity. And if I were your father, I'd be very proud of you. That's the first thing I want to say. Secondly, a quick question that I think is a real one. Dostoevsky, said that as mortals we can cope with virtually anything but freedom. I wanted you to make a response as to how the typical Moscovite male with a bottle of vodka in his hand at night is coping with freedom.
Okay, to rephrase the question, how a typical Russian, we mentioned a man living in Moscow drinking too much, copes with all this freedom. I will tell you, I hesitate to speak in generalizations because I haven't talked to I don't frequent the dens of men who drink vodka. But I see on the street, and when I was in Petersburg just last month, at the end of June, very regularly, every couple of days, the Stalinists would set up on the street, the main street, right in the center of town. They had their red Soviet flags out with the gold tassels and the fancy flags. They had their little mimeographed newspapers they were handing out. They would sometimes collect signatures for this or that petition. And they were selling portraits of Stalin. Nice frame quality, printed portraits of Stalin. And I looked at that, and I remembered Ginsburg and other people who suffered so badly under Stalinism. And I'm morally affronted is an understatement. It's repulsive to think that somebody wants Stalinism back, that somebody honors and venerates this monster who was responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of people. But as millions, even if you count, especially things that happened during the war. And if I did actually stop to talk to them once, and I bought a portrait of Stalin, which cost me 20 cents. I was going to bring it here to show you, but I lost it during my travels to and fro. I felt like I was lying because I said, "Oh, tell me about your movement. What do you know about Stalinism? Would you like to know more?" The totalitarian missionaries. No, and they just have an extremely narrow view of things, and they look back to the good things of Stalin. We've heard about this in the press before, and they look back to, and they believe in conspiracies. They, for example, showed me the memoirs of the one of the people who was close to the dictator in Albania and about how this had been repressed and wasn't this awful. And I know from other sources this dictator in Albania was just a monstrous on a Stalinist scale, but he had a smaller country. And freedom, to many people, is scary, I think. I think I understand that economically they're suffering because Russia is suffering. But it's, I think, more that there's something about freedom which does scare people. Jane Ann and then Doe.
Well, I'll just share my own experiences from having gone to Russia a year ago. I was able to meet and hang out with some academics there. One of mine in Moscow is a professor at Moscow State University, and then a geographer and some people. The general impression of people is that they are unemployed, underemployed, and if they are employed, they're unpaid. Natasha, who's a professor at Moscow State University, hadn't received a paycheck in, 6 months, and when she was paid, it was like $30 a month. My friend in St. Petersburg trained as a geologist, and yet she was working as a product demonstrator for Tefal Suspect. So, that is kind of my experience, but the general feeling that I got from people was generally optimistic. The vibe you could feel from people and on the street is cautiously optimistic. So it was generally a positive feeling. And there's lots of rebuilding going on and stuff like that. But there's still, little babushka selling herbs on the street corners by the metro.
Yeah.
For bowls to eat.
Though.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
I was in Berlin this year, and I did have an opportunity, which was the most fascinating part of my trip, is talking to people. Where were you when the wall came down? How did this affect you? I met a couple of youth, which surprised me, who were very resentful of the wall coming down. Now people, everybody doesn't get educated, and everybody doesn't get a job. And they were extremely discouraged by, quote, the westernization of what was taking place over there. And the sense I got from some of them is not only were they did they feel it was causing them personal hardship, but they were all of a sudden embracing the ideas that had been given to them, the ideals that had been given to them by their government. And I have known people within the LDS community or other religions who want the bishop to tell them what kind of birth control they should use.
Oh, what kind of?
Yeah.
None, maybe?
My brother was a bishop, and he would have people who would come in and want specifics about exactly what they're supposed to do with their life. And I see the similarity between these people who I spoke to who were longing for the government to say, you're going to go to school here, you're going to do this kind of work, and you're going to live here. And I see the similarity of these people who need somebody else to make the decision for them because the freedom to make their own choice is beyond their comprehension. It's beyond their ability to reach out. They're too afraid of their own process of learning and making wrong decisions. And it's that fear. And I've seen people who they want the general glories to tell them every single detail of their life. And it's like a comfort zone to them. It's like a security blanket.
Yeah. And the one thing that's pointed out with this is that Sunstone can never and it will never set itself up as a rival to general authorities in that sense, because anybody who comes to Sunstone is not the kind who says, "Yes, tell me exactly what I should do. I'll go home and do it." You know, this is.
Disappointed in this presentation.
I'm sorry. All right, you want your list of 10 things to go home and do. And so, in that sense, saying that people who write or who publish are setting themselves up as a rival to the general authorities is like comparing apples and coconuts. It's or something completely different. Right, because the people who are writing because they believe there should be lots of voices and people should have something to say. It's exactly the opposite. We should finish. All right, just finish with one last little story, which is relevant to the gathering here. I was directly before I came here. I was staying in a university town in Estonia. I was investigating the legacy of this Russian scholar who'd been sent there because he was exiled from St. Petersburg, basically. And he had died a couple of years ago. But he is the single greatest thinker in literature and literary studies to come out of Russia in about this century. And now everybody's reading him. And he was isolated in this little tiny Estonian town. I went to talk to some of his students who'd worked under him. And they explained to me how some of it worked. They said, we got some of the best students who would come here deliberately to work for him. What would happen is they would be studying Moscow or Petersburg or one of the great universities, and periodically the faculty would call the students together and they would say, there has been a book published by Lotman. Do not read this book. It is very bad. And some of them probably thought it was very bad, and some of them were using this sort of reverse-coded language like, this is the best thing published, you know, go out and read it. And then they would quit the school where they were, and they would transfer to this Estonian town because they had been told that basically this was the most anti-Soviet intellectual enterprise that they could enlist in. And that's what they did. That's a good sign. Thank you.